This is part two of the interview with Bill Wally. Shall we continue? What kind of problems did you run into with, say, a large amount of people around the transmitter?
Well, I don't know if you'd call it a problem. When you have a large amount of people who are suddenly stranded from their homes and have little kitties with them, in many cases small babies, and didn't have a chance to bring any food or any of the things that we get used to, like dry clothing and milk for babies, people sometimes panic a little bit. In the case of the folks up on the hill, and that's the people we were primarily concerned with, because we were involved right with them there. We were trying to help everybody, but the people were there physically on the hill. We found that the panic wasn't as widespread as it might have been. When you think that you're a father and you've got a child and it doesn't have any milk and you're not knowing if any milk's coming, you're not really sure what's the next step and what the next few days hold for you, I can see myself feeling that panicky feeling that you sometimes get. We had a little panic. We had, out of a large group of very fair and people who were just tripping over each other, trying to help each other, we had those few who threatened us, who raised a few problems in getting food. People who were pretty good people, but who just were worried, scared a little bit about food problems. There were people who were strewn all over that hill, of course, on both sides, a farmer's loop up the Chino Hot Springs Road. People who were miles and miles away from our transmitter, too, and who had no gasoline in their automobiles, had babies with them. People who walked for miles to get food and would come there, and several times, right at the first of the tragedy, we had no food to give them. Of course, all they had left to do was to walk all the way back to where they'd left their family and friends, miles away. Do that about twice, and you might get a little angry, you see, when you're walking with a pack on your back. This happened a couple of times. It never had a chance to develop into anything very dramatic. One time we had to call some state troopers out to stop a fight that was unrelated to the food, because there were several, well, there were hundreds of people there waiting around in a food distribution point. And a fight broke out that was unrelated to the food. Short tempers, people without sleep, this can happen. And my engineers actually handled that fight themselves, physically handled it, with no problem. I have big engineers. And that was the only real physical breakout. We had some fellas who had guns in their cars, to be perfectly honest with you, who would kid, come up to the transmitter and kid about the fact that they had the guns in the car and that they wanted food. But nobody really actually pointed a gun at us and said, all right, give us what you have. It never came to that, and I don't believe it ever would have, due to the fact that I think first the people would have started to head back for town and work some way to get the food if the agencies hadn't come to the rescue. Of course, the agencies did before it even got too hot at all, the Salvation Army and the Red Cross.
In discussing a panic, how did you, say, handle news of deaths? Like, there were five reported deaths that were accounted for in the Anchorage paper, but they still weren't being mentioned on the air. Is this something that you felt it wasn't the proper time to alarm people, that there was an unidentified child or something found?
There's a twofold thing here. First, we didn't get the information. We didn't have Associated Press wire, of course, for 5 or 6 days. The only information we had is that it was filtering to us through civil offense, which didn't bother to give us a death report. They were too busy saving lives to worry about those that had died at that point. And also the fact that what you say is true. There were times when we felt that a death announcement would not be the thing. Too many people were separated from their family and friends, and it would just add another burden to their already many worries if they thought, well, I haven't seen my wife in 7 days. And that was the case in many instances, you know. Families were separated for 7 or 8 days with no idea of where they were at or what they were doing. And in fact, I have one story about a young lady in Hamilton Acres, and this came after the flood in a letter to our radio station. There were two boats, evidently, and a lot of people got in both boats. One lady was handed a 7-month-old baby. Had no idea the baby's name or who the mother was, but figured that the mother was somewhere in one of the two boats. The boats then divided their ways. One went to the university, the Steese Cutoff. The other one went to the Lathrop High School, and the one that went to Lathrop had the mother in it, and the one who went to the university had the other, the child in it, and she didn't find the mother for 7 days and took care of the baby. Now, the mother knew that the baby was in the hands of a young lady, but never knew exactly how well the baby was being taken care of. Caused a lot of problems there. I'm not going to use any names, but once again, the young lady just took good care of the baby, and the mother got back together with the baby in about 7 days. But a lot of people were separated that way. Just didn't know what was going on. And that's the reason that the death notices were... We held back on those. We did make the announcements when things had cooled down a little bit, when people were getting notices from other people that so-and-so is all right, and so on and so forth.
Right, right. Do you have something, Pete?
No, I was just going to...
Did you have any... How good were your communications with Civil Defense? Were they constantly feeding you information, or were they too involved in the actual saving of lives? Did they have a chance to sit back and tell you how things were going and what you could expect and what the people could
only
expect?
Only the utmost emergencies did they actually feed us as mm-hmm. such. We had contact. We could call them. We had a Civil Defense ham plus a radio directly into the mayor's office, directly into the city government's office. After a few days now, this is. We had mm-hmm. a couple of days where we didn't have much anything mm-hmm. in the way of communications. Or was it a day? It's really difficult for me to tell you. You tell you the honest truth. But we had pretty close contact with all of the agencies after a day or so. As far as radio contact was concerned, it wasn't always easy to get the right people because the right people were very busy. It wasn't a case where a man could sit in an office and direct. The man had to get out in his fish boots and swim to the location if that was the only way to get there and direct that way. So many times you would get third and fourth people in line as far as authority is concerned, and that created some difficulties, but not really a whole lot.
Mm-hmm. I see. How good were your communications, say, with the university? Were you you mentioned that Dr. Wood was down several times.
Well, our communications with the university were by car or legwork. Of course, we're located fairly near the university, and the route to the university from the transmitter was dry all the time by going up the back road, and so we just had people move by car. After a while, we got a phone to the dispensary up there, and of course, I'll tell you what, the people at the Geophysical Institute were unbelievable. They, of course, ran us lines after the real panic, or I shouldn't say panic, because we really didn't have any panic, you know. It was the most unusual thing. But after the tragedy had died down a little bit, they ran us lines from the Geophysical Institute to KFAR, overland, to get us an Associated Press wire and to get us a telephone and also to get us a line to the dispensary at the University of Alaska for some type of communications for doctors who were working out of our remote hospital and also the dispensary at the university, which was also set up as a hospital. And our contact with the university was poor for a couple of days, except for driving back and forth with the car, and then it, with the lines, of course, was not normal, but as close to normal as you can get under the conditions.
I see. Now, another aspect that we haven't discussed yet is your relationship with the university. Now, we know that you asked for a couple of announcers from Eielson Air Force Base, I believe, to come up and assist you.
Uh-huh.
Would you discuss this and any other kind of, say, military assistance that assisted you in taking care of the emergency?
Well, without the choppers, what would have happened to Fairbanks? That just about answers that. I'm not all familiar with everything the military did.
I meant particularly with the radio station.
With the radio station? You bet. The military was... Well, they did everything they could for us that wouldn't take away from the saving of lives. You know, they saved an awful lot of lives with those choppers. The Ween commercial chopper service also just turned three choppers over to us to use as we saw fit due to the fact that they knew that we were getting the main lines of communications, and therefore they just landed out there at the transmitter and said, where do you want us to go? And we found out where they should go, and they went. Did all kinds of things. Take me 5 hours to tell you all about them. The military sent in supplies and all kinds of things on choppers. And then I requested when our announcers, both of us, were getting pretty tired after a week or so. We had engineers, of course. I shouldn't say that because it's not really the truth. It's a fact that we had everybody announcing after a while. We had the office girls who had made it out to the transmitter. We had engineers. We had people who walked by the transmitter and said, I'm an announcer, and they were working in 5 minutes. We had all kinds of people. The University of Alaska, of course, was on the air, too, with their FM station, so they were pretty well tied up. So I asked the Armed Forces Radio, on the radio, of course, once again, our only communications are what we did on the air. Every favor you asked for and every need you had, you just went on the air, and in very conversational tones, you asked for it. And then I went on the air, and I asked the commander at Allison if I could have a couple of Armed Forces Radio announcers to help us out, and they were there in 10 minutes by chopper. So the military was right there every time you needed them. Of course, they had a few problems of their own with the flood, as you know, at Fort Wainwright and even in the backside of Allison.
Discussing choppers now, we're coming towards, I believe, the end of the week when the mobile cars are starting to operate again and the choppers are starting to operate again. When did you actually start broadcasting from the choppers?
We never actually broadcast from a chopper because our radio gear that we had taken to the transmitter wasn't strong enough. What we did, every hour we sent one of our boys up in the chopper to take a survey of the area, and he would come back and just give an extensive report on what he had seen. We had one chopper that was made available to us, well, not just for broadcasting, because we were doing, you know, a half dozen other things besides broadcasting, but there was a chopper, for instance, that took Jerry Springer out to the Badger Road area. When he got out there, he went out there to give a report, and they found out that he was a medic, and he gave shots to 200 kids while he was there. He helped outline the food program in some of those areas by chopper. We were doing all these different things because, once again, we were sort of a center, and people looked to us for authority that we really didn't have, but we had to take. In my own case, as a city councilman, they kept coming to me to take authority in areas that I had no authority and had to take in some instances just to get the job done in different areas. And the choppers, of course, were... Well, I can't even start to tell you the first day I saw a chopper. I couldn't even venture a guess, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm. Could you discuss, say, anything about your functions as a city councilman and a member of the borough assembly at this time? Or was most of this delayed till after the emergency ended?
In an official capacity, it was, yes. We had several meetings up on the hill, but most of the council and the assembly was scattered all over the area and was unable to move. Transportation was nil. And communications was nil, so they couldn't tell us, several of them couldn't tell us where they were at to get transportation to them. We never actually met officially as the council until the Monday night that we got back into town, which was, I guess, the Monday a week from the 14th. We had an official meeting that night. But primarily, each individual councilman, each individual assemblyman took a part in a semi-official capacity as much as he could. I know a couple of assemblymen, Con Miller and a couple of the other ones, were suddenly be made food distributors, as I was up on the hill. They were out in the other area by North Pole. And everybody tried to take, because they had the elected position, take as much official responsibility as possible in each area they were at. And that's about all you could do at that particular time until communications were put back together again.
Let me see. You were at the emergency ended, when did you phase it out at the radio station? Was this sometime Monday night?
It was the following Monday night that we came back into town. There was still water around, of course, but we were able to get back to the fourth floor of the Lathrop building, and we then moved another generator in here. It didn't have power here for quite some time after that, but we did operate on generator from here and also got our TV on a few nights later, operating from a generator.
Right, I remember that. Is there anything else that you can think of that you'd like to discuss or mention?
Well, as I've said before, I don't know what would have happened if this flood would have taken place in Los Angeles, California. But here in Fairbanks, the people were, just tremendous. And through their own initiative, they say themselves, a lot of heartache and a lot of anguish. And this is one of those kind of tragedies that a whole lot of credit goes to a whole lot of people, or I should say a little credit goes to a whole lot of people, and not a real large amount of credit goes to any one small group or one person.
Someone mentioned that Alaskans are probably adventurous enough to take the responsibility that you were mentioning, or the initiative, into their own hands and do things without any kind of authority, and this is probably what saved Fairbanks.
Thank God. Right, because they did that, and that's what saved the loss of life, of course, and made the thing even on a psychological basis easier to take.
Right.
There was humor during the entire thing. Here's a fella maybe up there on the hill who knows his home is wiped out, not sure where his family is, but had the courage to inject a little humor on the thing. And like there was a fellow over on Hilton who his house was being flooded, and he puts a sign up, house for sale, lakefront.
Right.
You know, a lot of things like that kept spirits up, and that's important in a case of this kind.
Well, I remember when you were playing some of the records on the radio station, you casually joked that this was one of the first times you'd ever had a captive radio station where people were feeding you records that you had to play.
Well, that's, and that happened, of course,
right,
too.
Right.
Right. Gave us some pretty good records, too.
Yes, right.
Someday we're going to give them back.
Is there anything else you can think of, Pete?
No, I think he's covered everything. I was going to ask about this authority. Who is, when official authorities kind of became submerged, who was it that took over? But you covered that with this kind of individual initiative.
I didn't mean the authorities themselves. The city manager in the civil offense structure is in complete charge. And Wally was, at all times, in charge, right from the beginning. When I said that individuals took authority, I meant in areas where the authority just couldn't get to by communications, because communications were just about nil, except for the radio station, and we couldn't get everything out. And even if you could get to them by transistor radio, if you're stuck with 4 feet of water around you, what do you do, you know? So, now, Wally was in complete charge of civil offense when the thing turned into a tragedy. He had things under control pretty much as far as the actual manipulating of the civil offense area. Jack Murphy, of course, is the local director. They did have to move a lot because of the water kept shoving them around, you know. And this caused some hitches, but they came out pretty well. And while he had complete authority, the mayor of Fairbanks took a lot of authority. And this is one of those cases where he had to. It just happens when you're an elected official. Sometimes in a tragedy like that, as we have found out, you have to take the authority that's there. If you don't, it may not be taken by anybody, and then people get in trouble.
In mentioning this authority, now, you said that Wally Droz was the man in charge. Now, was he really the key person executing most of the decisions, or was it the mayor who would be doing some of them or taking over the leadership or something like this?
Under the charter, the city manager is the man who is in complete charge in a disaster of any kind. In this particular case, the mayor had to fill up many gaps because there was, you know, there's only 24 hours in a day, and there was just too much for one man to handle. This is an opinion, by the way. I wasn't there. I was out on the hill. But there were gaps that had to be filled, and I think, after talking to the city manager, that each individual department head, as far as the city of Fairbanks was concerned, more or less had to take a lot of authority themselves, because, you see, they were right there. For instance, if there's a fire, the city manager is maybe in a place away from the fire, and the fire chief can see the fire, and he's got to make those decisions himself, because that's his job. And in a case of a flood where transportation is nil and the city manager can't get to the fire, it's up to the next in line or the head of the department to make those decisions, and a lot of those decisions had to be made by the heads of the different departments.
Then, say, just to sum it up, you found yourself, say, functioning as a clearinghouse not only for priority messages from officials and companies and personal messages of families trying to communicate, but you also, I think, as I remember, took a leading role in surveying food needs up on the hill and distributing food distribution. And did you initiate the medical clinic up there too, or was this something that just naturally occurred because of the people and your own interests?
At first we were contacting doctors over the radio, and then some of the doctors came to the transmitter and asked us what would be a better way, and a hospital, tent hospital of some type, was suggested. And they immediately had a meeting and put it into effect themselves there at the KFAR transmitter. As far as the distribution of food and the survey, that was done by request of the mayor, who, I called the mayor on the radio, and he was there in a matter of moments by helicopter with the Red Cross director, and they told us what they needed in order to distribute food in the area, and we took it upon ourselves then to do that. And they sort of put us in charge of Red Cross in that area until we could find other volunteers to take the job off of our hands. So we did that for a couple of days, and then Bill Simon, who's a local banker, volunteered to help and suddenly found himself in charge because we were in charge of too many things at that time, and he continued after that point.
See, it's an interesting side, like, how did you get the youngsters to take this food survey? I remember you were asking for volunteers on motorbikes and this type of thing.
Our food survey was taken in several different ways, and we found out later on it was very accurate. We may take other surveys that way from now on. First, we had people from... we blocked off all the areas, and luckily we happened to have a map of the area. We later on asked for more maps, but we did have a rather crude map of the area. We blocked it off and asked volunteers to come, send one volunteer from each area with their food needs. And just about every area did have somebody show up with their food needs written on a piece of paper. And then as a double check on that, that same night, this all took place in about 12 hours. We surveyed, you know, about, well, thousands of people in 12 hours. We sent the motorcycles out. We had about 14 young fellas who had their motorcycles up on the hill. We quickly assigned them to different areas, and they would actually take a head count, checking out the figures that were given to us by the people. Okay. And when the Red Cross came, which was about a day later, as far as the survey was concerned, we had it all laid out in a map for them, and then they, of course, gave the authority. By that time, I had appointed Bill to take my place, and then he was officially appointed by the Red Cross director, who was flown in by helicopter that afternoon, and they just gave him the official capacity to sign at the local grocery stores. We did have a problem, and Red Cross had a problem at that time, of getting the food from the downtown area up to the hill. And that was when I hate to use the word confiscated, let's say that I took over some of the public works department in the city of Fairbanks, and didn't take over, that's a bad word either, they volunteered, that's the best word I can think of. They volunteered, and they did. Russ Gillespie was one of the foremen of the public works department, and several of his crew had been stranded on the hill. And when they found, they wanted to do something, but they were sort of stranded. They wanted to do something. When they found out we needed vehicles, they had radios and everything, they said, "Wee Willie, what do you need?" And they went to work and got some dump trucks and boomed down the Safeway, and Bill Simon used his Red Cross signature, and we got the food and brought it back, and we fed the people, and it was as simple as that.
Very good, very good. Anything else, Pete? Well, I think that's about it. We thank you very much for the
interview.
Okay,
thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thanks for the information that you gave us.
All righty.